the neutrality patrol in the Atlantic, or they were underway with the Enterprise on the Lexington. So all the obsolescent ships are in Pearl Harbor. Of course, the hidebound, the big gun club, they weren't thinking in those days of battleships being obsolescent, but in reality they were, because they were too slow. And it was too hard to get them from A to B to C to D, and they ate up too much fuel. So,
I think that you made the – I'm not sure if it's in your book or I just read researching it – that when the other aircraft carriers did leave, the rest of the battleships couldn't keep up, so they just turned around and came back.
That's right. Well, normally Kimmel would have half the ships at sea on every weekend, but because the two carriers that were in Pearl were sent to deliver fighter planes to Wake and Midway, he says, well, I have to keep all the battleships in port because there's no carrier aircraft to protect them at sea. So that ended up being the reason why all the ships were in port, which is like, oh, my goodness. Talk about the domino effect.
I think we're probably going to wrap up here a little bit because, you know, we haven't even got into the attack on Pearl Harbor and Kimmel. But what I think we have got maybe is interested people to get your book, two books. That is,
sure.
There's a lot more behind the story here, how this thing was manipulated, maneuvered, very devious. And like you talked about some chess moves that maybe take 10 moves to come to fruition. I mean, the amount of cables, the spying on the Germans as well. I mean, and it seems that everybody needed this to happen to get the gears moving. I mean,
I don't think Admiral Stark and General Marshall were idiots. I think they were loyal to the president's policy of making the enemy strike first. And these guys knew, let's wrap it up with this thought. These guys knew that we had 47% of the world's manufacturing power. That's a new statistic I've come up with since I published the book. Japan had 3.5%. We had 47%. Germany had 14%. The British had, the Russians had 14%. The British 10%. We had almost half of the world's manufacturing power. This is of what was actually produced during the war. And we had a sense of this. And that's why no matter how badly the war would start, I don't think these people in Washington, our war planners, were that worried about the Japanese. The planning already was that Germany would be first and we would be on the defensive against Japan until Hitler was defeated, and then we would crush Japan. That was always the planning. And I'd like to leave this with one thought then. I know we got to wrap this up. I think people should get the book and focus on the testimony of Admiral Turner, General Marshall, Admiral Stark, Secretary of War Stimson. But I'll leave you with one quote from Harry Hopkins. Now, Harry Hopkins was the Secretary of Commerce, but he was really the unofficial deputy president for Roosevelt. And he wrote a memo the day of the attack on Pearl Harbor, when the admirals and generals all met at the White House that afternoon. And listen to what he said, and then that'll be my swan song for tonight. He said, quote, "The conference met in not too tense an atmosphere, because I think that all of us believed that in the last analysis, the enemy was Hitler, and that he could never be defeated without force of arms, that sooner or later we were bound to be in the war, and that Japan had given us an opportunity," end quote. That's the day of the attack, when you would normally expect somebody to be in a state of panic. No panic.
Yeah. A number of people have made the comment that Roosevelt seemed a little bit too calm.
Yep.
That, you know, and you do you recall the quote from Churchill that night?
Oh, he many fine quotes, which I think I used them all. He wept with joy that he says, "After all, I know we've now won the war." He was he slept well for the first time in like 2 years. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
He says, "Now we've won." And that's what he said the day that we were attacked, because he knew what it meant.
Now, what you'll find if people purchase your book is it's for a lot of it, it's kind of like an Excel spreadsheet, and you get a date and you get the dates, then you get the event, what happened, and then there's the remarks and often, you know, quoting documents and that. And when I first got it, And to tell you the truth, I even hesitated. I thought, I can't read this. And I found it a little uncomfortable. I just wanted to tell you, though, I got used to it. I got used to it. And then finally in book two, when you come back to, I think, halfway through that, your conclusions and remarks about the whole story, the complete Pearl Harbor conclusions, Franklin D. Roosevelt, master of the game. And this is quite a game. It's back to normal and page by page. But if somebody does get it and it's a bit of a shock, I just wanted to mention it was a bit of a shock to me too, but I got used to it. And
well, and that, I did that because no one had ever published a chronology of events as they happened. And in some cases, it leads you to causality. I mean, the causality of different events becomes quite apparent when you put them in a timeline. That's why I did that.
You'll get, I think, a deeper, I'm not sure if respect is the right word, but understanding of Roosevelt and what he was up against. And
understanding, and, yes.
Yeah, I mean, quite a bit different than I thought of him. I thought of him, you know, as a, I shouldn't say this, you know, with any malice or anything. I thought of him as like a, you know, an uncle or a daughtering, you know, grandfather,
right,
something figure like that. And he was the opposite of that, especially. I was very surprised on his animosity to Churchill and to the UK. And I never dreamed that'd be happening. I mean, it's, I learned quite a bit. I learned quite a bit, I'll say that.
Well, thank you, Len. I've really enjoyed discussing this with you, and I know you've given me a very generous amount of time, and I thank you so much, and encourage
well, you know
everyone
what?
To...
You're welcome, but I do have, I've got about 40 questions I went through, and I'm dropping a
oh.
few of them. But, oh, I've got more than that. I've got 6 pages of stuff here. But like I said to you, that the reason we held off the interview is I wanted to make sure I read this and did some other work. I have a last question, so I will tell you, this is going to be our wrap-up question, though, but I wanted to ask you what role you thought maybe the FBI should have had in this, because there's quite a lot of spying. I'm at a bit of a loss to explain the FBI's role well, how would you describe the FBI in the surprise attack?
They looked more competent to me than I expected to find. I know I didn't write about it in my book, but in other books there are accounts of a Governor Burns, a man who was governor of Hawaii, and was visited by President Kennedy in June of '63. Governor Burns. That Governor Burns, when he was a younger man, claims that he was told by an FBI agent that Pearl Harbor is going to be attacked, you know, next week. And that it scared the hell out of him. That's really interesting. We know that, and I wrote about this, we know that J. Edgar Hoover knew about the Japanese spy in the consulate who was sending the weekly and maybe twice a week reports on the positions of all the U.S. ships in Pearl Harbor. He knew about that spy. And his link with Roosevelt was a diplomat named Adolf Burrell. And Burrell passed on the message to Hoover that, no, you're not allowed. Hoover wanted to arrest the guy and throw him in jail or arrest him and deport him. And the answer was, no, you're not allowed to do that. The president knows he's the spy, and that would reveal our code-breaking success, and we can't reveal that to the Japanese, so you cannot arrest the man. So I think they were as diligent as they could be in some areas.
But
and,
when you read these
it's
things,
just the
you
game
start
was
to...
a lot bigger than them, you know?
Yeah, but when you read this, you start to wonder who didn't know about the attack coming.
I know, I know. That's right. You start to wonder who didn't. You know, the suspects right now, the list of suspects is George Marshall, Admiral Stark, Admiral Turner, Admiral Wilkinson, the head of ONI, apparently at least one FBI agent in Hawaii. I think his name was Shivers. Certainly the Dutch naval attaché, Commander McCollum, and, of course, the code breakers, well, not the code breakers, the people at the intercept stations in the Pacific Rim who had the radio direction-finding equipment who were reporting positions of ships, they certainly knew something was coming toward Hawaii.
And you made
by
the
way,
you made the comment that the British were possibly a year ahead in this
yes.
code breaking.
Yes,
So
in JN-25 code breaking. Yes, we had effect, according to Captain Safford of the U.S. Navy. Years later, we had effectively solved the JN-25 puzzle by December 7th, but we were reading traffic that was a month old in Washington. It was being sent by airplane and ship and train to Washington after it was intercepted. So that's the tragedy from that standpoint, is they had essentially solved it and more or less knew how to do it. They didn't have enough people. The people were devoted to the diplomatic magic messages. They didn't have enough people devoted to breaking JN-25, and they were reading month-old messages. But the British had a lot more people assigned to it, both at Bletchley Park and in the Far East, and they were way ahead of us, way ahead.
Right, and you start thinking with some common sense about November 26th and the messages that were going out then. I mean,
right.
You know.
Like the vacancy message and the war warnings the next day and everything else, right? And the carriers, send the carriers out to deliver fighter planes. So there's a lot to chew on here. And, it's a nuanced argument, but I think it's the best synthesis of all the revisionist arguments in the past. I think I've put together things, connected the dots in a better way than some of the older revisionist historians who were writing in the late 40s and early 50s and the mid 50s. And we know a lot more now than we knew then.
Now, how long have you spent on this? How long did it take you to write these two books?
The two volumes took off and on. I worked on it for 6 years, a lot of times only on the weekends. And then you reach something in your life happens and you have to put it down for a while. And then you always go back to it, but off and on for 6 years, from 2010 to the end of 2016.
Well, I'll leave you with this. Mr. Horn, I learned an awful lot from reading your books, so I hope other people get that out of it as well.
Thank you. Thank you
All
so
right.
much.
And
Take
thank
care.
You for spending time with me to discuss this. And once again, where is the book available? Amazon?
Amazon.com, Deception, Intrigue, and the Road to War. Or you can put in my last name, Horne, and just type FDR, and it'll pop right up.
Yeah. Do you have a personal website?
Not for this book. I don't.
Oh, I thought you had a blog page, I thought.
Right. I've got an old blog page inside the ARRB. I did announce the publication of this book. But other than that, I haven't really promoted it as much as I should have. So for that reason, I thank you very much for the time.
All right. Okay. Thank you very much. And I'll speak to you. Are you working on another book? Are you still going to be writing?
No, or? I'm trying to catch my breath. I am going to teach it. I'm so excited. I'm going to teach a course about this book. It's to retired adults. It's a retired adult education. It's going to be this fall here in Cleveland. And I'm going to have a lot of fun. I've never taught a course before. I've already got the PowerPoint finished. All 151 slides are ready to go. I can't wait.
Please let me know when you're ready for that, and I'll have you on again, and we can promote that and make sure people in that area know how to sign up for it. And
thank you.
Yeah, you're very welcome.
Okay,
all
well,
right,
take
then.
Care.
Good.